Hey, it's Francis Lam. Thanks so much for downloading this week's podcast. And if you like it, please share it. Leave us a review where you found it. It really helps us out. You can also find recipes and videos and information on just about everything else you hear today on our website, splendidtable.org. But right now, let's get to this week's show. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table. From APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. Peru is home to one of the great cuisines of the world, but most people, me included, mostly know it's seafood. You know, ceviche and sushi, because Nobu, the most famous sushi chef in the world, got his start there. But the chef Martin Morales, who actually has two restaurants named Ceviche, just wrote a cookbook called Andina, and he thinks you have to go a little higher than sea level to get to the soul of Peruvian food. So hi, Chef Martin, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thanks for joining us. So I want to ask you, because your first book is called Ceviche. You have a popular restaurant based on ceviche. And I think, you know, the dish probably most associated with Peruvian cuisine around the world is ceviche, which is fish, so probably coastal. But you say that the highlands of the Andes are, you know, where you find the heart of Peruvian food. Why?
Well, people today around the world, the few or the many people that know about Peruvian food know it as an introductory. The introduction to Peruvian food is really based on what is coastal cuisine. And that's really based on some indigenous cuisine influence, but certainly the migration of the last 500 years from Spanish, Italian, Chinese, Japanese, and African people, all of which has created this beautiful explosion of what is Peruvian food. But the origins lie in our indigenous cuisine that date back thousands of years before the land known now as Peru was not called that. It was called something else. And these Andean regions that not only stretch from the top and the bottom of Peru, but to other countries north and south of Peru. But certainly in the Andes of Peru and the regions of the Andes, there's just a wealth of ingredients, a wealth of dishes, cooking techniques. And for me, that is the heart of our cuisine. Without that, we're much less poorer gastronomically. And I also think it's very important to pay credit to that history and that legacy and the people that still support that in the Andes of Peru, the growers, the chefs, the picanteras, as I call them, the women chefs who run these wonderful picanteria restaurants, these family-run restaurants, which uphold this tradition of dishes that sometimes are 50 or 100 years old, sometimes are 500 or 1,000 years old.
And what would you say are some of the defining aspects of Andino cooking?
Well, look, I think the fascinating thing about particularly Andean cuisine within Peruvian cuisine is that, look, we have been zero waste, organic, nose to tail, farm to table for thousands of years. It's not fashion. It's not a trend. It's not hip. It's just something that we are. And that is defining. That is legacy. That is history. And that is good for the world. Of course, there's also ingredients that define us. You might know we are one of the major homes in the world for potatoes and for different types of corn, different types of grains and seeds like quinoa and amaranth and maca and kiwicha and canigua. And there's different types of chilies that are native to the Andes of Peru, whether it's Amarillo chili, which many people have come to discover through Peruvian food, or whether it's limo chili or panca chili or a smoked chili. You know, in Mexico, they have chipotle. In Peru, we have panca chili. It's different. It's smoky. It's delicious. Mm-hmm. And also some of the fruits and vegetables. We have lucuma. Lucuma, you go to any health food shop in the US, in the UK, in France, you ask for lucuma, you'll get lucuma powder. We grow it fresh. It's native to Peru. And it tastes like butterscotch, but it's high in nutrients. And there are different types of corns, which I mentioned before as well as different herbs and other fruits. And also techniques. We have pachamanca, which is cooking underground. There's different ways of fermenting. There's different ways of drying as well, which are unique to the Andes of Peru.
So the Andes of Peru are they're sort of the spiritual home of potatoes, right? Like, this is where potatoes come from.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. That's what people say.
So what are some of the things that you do with potatoes?
Apart from juggle them. No, I'm kidding. We use them a lot in something called causa. Causa, which translated means the cause. And causa is just, it's a bit like a potato salad. We flavor a mashed potato with some chilies, some lime juice, some different ingredients, and use that as a base. Like people use bread and, you know, a bun or a piece of toast. We use that as a base and put toppings. And the word causa is fascinating in itself, and the actual dish and the origins of the dish. Because the origins of the dish come from a war that we had with our southern neighbors. And there was nothing left to eat on the front line for the soldiers, the Peruvian soldiers. And the wives of the Peruvian soldiers only had potatoes and scraps of food. So they created this cold dish with potatoes and they added those scraps on top and they presented that to the soldiers. They seasoned it beautiful with all their love and care and, you know, in their last final efforts of the battle. And they said, this is for the cause. And that was the dish, and that's how that dish was born. So that's one of the many different potato dishes that we have.
Oh, wow.
But the great thing about potatoes is the sheer variety of potatoes. So they say that in the world there are 3,500 varieties. They say that 2,500 varieties of those come from Peru, from the native land of the Andes of Peru.
Oh, cool. Let me ask you about someone you write about in the book, because I'm fascinated by her and her story. There's a woman that you introduced to us named Feli. Tell us about her.
So, I was born into, I guess, a lower middle class father's family from the UK, and a lower middle class or working class or peasant kind of family in Peru who was Andean. But I grew up in Lima in a way, in a what you might describe as a little bit of a privileged lifestyle, because the extremes between rich and poor are huge in Peru. So even if you have a little bit of money, you're considered pretty wealthy. And life is tough and people have to work. And in a way, we were lucky enough to have a housekeeper that could, you know, cook for us at times, live with us at times, or stay over some days a week. But that also meant that in a way I was abandoned by my mother, because she had to work and she had to be elsewhere. And many people might say, well, you know, that's a privilege that you've got, to have a helping hand. And in a way, I can't argue with that. That is, I was lucky to have that. But in another way, it's sad that my mother wasn't closer to me and lived with me more often, shall I say, or was able to be with me from a very young age. So Feli was the person, took the role of, I guess, like a second mother. She was a lady, an Inca lady, an indigenous lady from an Andean region called Huancavelica. Her legs were thick and strong, and her arms were big and muscly, and she had black hair, and she had the most warm smile. In effect, she was a housekeeper, but she was also, as I say, a mother. She was also the person who cooked for me from very, very young age. And I grew very, very attached to her through the years. Huancavelica is a region that has been destroyed by mining, destroyed by terrorism. And we felt that destruction through the lives, through the stories that Feli told me, and through the stories that Feli lived, even while she was working with us. And so I talk about her in my book, because she was not only an influence in terms of my care and the love I received from someone, from her, but also in terms of my culinary influences. She was the first person that taught me how to cook a boiled egg, which was the first thing I cooked. You know, she taught me how to cook basic Peruvian dishes. And when I left Peru, because my father was threatened by the Shining Path guerrillas for being English and for working for an American company, he wasn't a politician. He didn't care about politics. And we weren't a wealthy family by any means. But because he had a senior role in an American company in Lima in the mid-80s, they threatened him. So we had to leave, because it was horrible living under the destruction and the violence that Peru was suffering at the time. It's a whole different world now. It's a whole different world. Mm-hmm. It's an incredible, flourishing, exciting, safe country now. But back then it was dangerous.
Sure.
So we lived under armed guard for a year. And then my father said, enough's enough. So I came to the UK. and I lost my surfing because I was in love with surfing. I lost my love for the coast and my love for the Andes. I lost my cuisine and my dishes and my treats and my friends, but I also, and some family members, of course, when I moved to the UK. But I also lost Feli. I didn't lose her in terms of communication. We've always kept in touch. So for the last 30 years, whenever I've traveled to Peru, I go and see her and I stay with her and we cook and we reminisce, and I owe her a great deal.
That's lovely, Chef. Thank you so much for sharing that story with us. I mean, when I read about her in the book, I had noticed the part where you said, you know, there were dishes that she told you about when you were young that you never actually got to eat with her, that she never cooked for you. And what an incredible feeling it must be now to be able to cook those dishes for her. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on, Francis. And I hope to serve you some delicious dishes if you're ever dropping by London.
Martin Morales is the author of Andina, the Heart of Peruvian Food. And if you want a taste of it, he shared a recipe with us for pesque de quinoa. It's a kind of baked quinoa with garlic, cheese, and cream. And you can find that recipe at splendidtable.org. So I've never been to Peru, but I dream of it. And if I ever do, I hope I get to a restaurant in Lima called Central. It's supposed to be incredible. And the idea is that all the dishes are created according to the ingredients they find at different altitudes. So they all represent different ecosystems, from, you know, the clams at sea level to Amazonian fruits and mountain herbs and preserved potatoes. And the cooking is supposed to be brilliant, but all I keep imagining is the part that I can't imagine. You know, like, what do all these ingredients I've never heard of taste like? I once had a meal in a restaurant, and there was a dish that had a few leaves of huacatay, which they said was an herb they got from Peru. And like, I could throw words at you like mint and tarragon and lime zest, but the fact is it tasted like nothing I've ever had in my life. And the thought of a whole cuisine built on flavors that are literally unlike anything you ever had before is, that's just an unbelievable thrill. So I think a lot of what Martin Morales was talking about, a lot of what inspires him, are the high-up ingredients of the Andes that you don't see elsewhere, and wanting to bring those flavors to his guests in London. But when I re-listened to our interview, the thing that really stands out to me is how proud he is telling the story of the causa, and the warmth, the sound of his voice when he's talking about Feli, the woman who raised him. And I don't want to assume too much, like maybe the thing that does keep him going is the taste of the original potato, but I kind of feel like for him, his food is ingredients, it's ecosystems, but it really comes down to culture and to people. And truthfully, I was thinking about this because we got a listener email the other day that, you know, was kind of a complaint. The listener was bummed out. She wants more cooking tips and flavor combinations and what to do with chickpeas. And hey, I love chickpeas, so I'm happy to get more chickpea cooking tips in. But there was a line in her email that struck me. And she was kind of upset that what she's been hearing on our show is, quote, more about people than cooking. Well, I mean, honestly, I hope we'll make a show that she'll love and that you'll all love and that you'll get great cooking ideas from us. But I do think people are the most important part of cooking. And later on, we've got another story that's about people as much as it's about cooking. But don't worry, we're going to talk about tubers, too.
Boniato is actually what most of the world calls a sweet potato. It is a white-fleshed sweet potato with a kind of pinky, purpley mottled skin, and it's very bulbous, kind of ugly, but it is really amazingly delicious.
I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
Splendid Table is brought to you by all the chickens at Locally Laid Egg Company. Producing high-quality, delicious eggs for over a decade, Locally Laid prioritizes good lives for their hens. Locally Laid Egg Company also partners with rural farmers to keep agriculture clucking along in Minnesota. Locally sourced, locally sold, that's Locally Laid. You can learn more about visiting the flock at the farm's Airbnb at locallylaid.com.
This is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters, and I'm your host, Francis Lam. If you've listened to our show over the past month or so, you know we took a trip to Philadelphia because I literally cannot stop talking about it. And one of the highlights of that trip was going to El Compadre, a slip of a place that got its start as an informal in-home restaurant called South Philly Barbacoa. And people kept telling me I had to get there, that it was going to be the best Mexican roast lamb I'll ever have. And spoiler alert, they were right. Like, the barbacoa came out, steam roasted and then kind of gently frying in its own fat, and the whole room smelled like toasted avocado leaves and roasted oranges and seared lamb. But as awe-inspiring as the lamb was, the chef, Christina Martinez, was even more so. She runs this tiny little restaurant with a construction cooler of drinks by the cash register, but you can tell something special is happening there. They grind corn grown especially for them to make tortillas in the back. There are letters on the walls from the city council honoring her for her activism, and there's a photo of Martin Luther King hanging by the kitchen. And Christina's just everywhere all at once, but when it came time to bring out the barbacoa, she finally slowed down and got this massive cleaver. And then she told me about what her cooking means to her and her community.
Well, thank you, Christina, for having us here at El Compadre. And this is a beautiful spread of barbacoa. Can you describe how you serve the barbacoa and what it is?
La barbacoa es de borrego. Tiene siete piezas. Esta es la costilla.
So barbacoa is a lamb, and it has seven pieces. Over here, we have the ribs. This is the shoulder, and this is the neck. Over here, we have some consomé, which is a soup, and it has rice and garbanzos, a bit of pasote, which is an herb. Over here, we have some salsas.
Salsa verde.
Salsa verde. Salsa roja.
Green sauce and red sauce. Some onions. Some cilantro that we clean and wash very well. And the barbacoa is a traditional food from Guerrero and Hidalgo, and her hometown known as Capurrac in Mexico. And having barbacoa basically means family, getting the family together in reunion to share this dish.
So you take the whole lamb.
Yeah.
You break it down into here's the shoulder, here's the ribs, here's the... You marinate it in, I mean, the aroma is incredible. I can smell the aguacate leaves. It's a very beautiful aroma. But you marinate for 8 hours and you steam it, or do you bake it, roast it?
A couple hours in the steam, because here it's very difficult for the un hoyo. It's difícil tener un hoyo para cocinar esta comida tan original.
She says that it's really hard to dig a hole here to actually make it, and so they do their best they can.
And how did you learn?
Pues mi mami estaba muy pequeña con mi familia.
5 generations. She learned when she was younger. There's 5 generations in her family that are making this kind of food.
And so when did you start making barbacoa here?
Porque me casé y perdí mis dos trabajos. Me corrieron del trabajo. Entonces, tuve que
she got married, and then right after she got married, she got fired, and so she really just needed to make money and, you know, to pay for bills and also to help support her family.
Yeah.
And so she just had to look for work and started working.
Vendíamos en un apartamento ilegal y invitando a la gente que pudiera pasar a comer.
She says she started selling in her apartment illegally at first, but then, you know, just to make money. And then there was an American man who came in and he took photos. He's like, you really need to make something out of this.
Yeah.
Who tried it out. And so that's how it kind of...
Yeah.
But who was coming in first and who came to enjoy this food?
Pues solamente los latinos porque mi esposo.
So it was mainly Latino communities. At first, in the beginning, she was actually scared to open it to an American to come into her apartment and see what she was doing. And so it was mostly the Latino community. And then finally, somebody came in, and then they're like, "Okay, so we're safe, we're good." But then it was a very nerve-wracking experience.
Yeah, but this was a very informal thing you were doing. But it also sounds like it became important within the community, where people felt like they could come and taste the barbacoa that maybe they had from where they were from and couldn't have here otherwise.
Entonces esto era algo muy informal cuando empezó, pero entonces la gente, que lo que atraía a la gente era algo como que algo que ellos no habían probado, algo
que no habían probado, que no se hace esta estación tan especial porque en ningún restaurante.
Yeah, what brought people to is because it was very intimate and it was very emotional to see a woman with a machete and just to cut, to see how it's prepared. When it's in a much fancier establishment or a regular restaurant, it's done, you know, in the back. But to see her chopping and how she's doing right now, just like serving it in a tortilla, it brings emotion and it intrigues people to come in and check it out to see that.
Where it feels like this is family cooking, this is home.
Yeah, exactly. Y pues en nuestros países de origen, como en China, como en México.
In our own origin countries, whether that's China or whether that's Mexico, in our own countries, we can open our doors to our own home and sell food. But somewhere here, like in the United States, it's not something that you can really do easily.
Sure. See, that's so interesting because it's also like we think about the experience of restaurants and we think about the ambiance and the decor and we think about, oh, the quality of the food and the skill of the cooking and the quality of the ingredients and all that stuff. But for so many people, they come from places where that's not what eating out is really about. That's not what eating is really about. Eating is about this feeling of being in a particular kind of place. And it sounds like she's created that kind of place where it felt essentially like an extension of your home.
Pues sí, porque tenemos, tengo más contacto con la gente directamente, puedo mirarle a los ojos, puedo saber.
The familiar experience that we're talking about is that she gets to see her clients and she gets to meet people one-on-one and look at them in the eye. She gets to see if they want a little bit of a fatty on the side, if they would like more, so they know that she's doing it for them.
Yeah, that's amazing. Can we taste one?
Yeah, sure. Ahora estamos cocinando la barbacoa halal because queremos que la comunidad, que no solamente sean los... Gracias.
This space is welcome to everybody and she welcomes everybody to come here, and so she makes halal food, so she wants, it's not for just Mexicans.
Que venga gente de todo el mundo.
She wants everyone, it's not for, you know, U.S. citizens, it's not for Americans, this is for everyone.
I love that.
Yeah.
Christina, did the feeling, that intimate community, intimate family feel change when you became popular and you came to your own space and you opened restaurants and then became, and where, you know, magazines started coming to you and journalists started coming to you and you started to develop a different crowd. Did that feeling change?
No, es un compromiso hacerlo todos los, siempre bien.
It's always been a compromise for her to always, you know, to not change. So she's always given it her all, whether that was just intimate or with other people. Recently, when her son passed away, it's been a little difficult, but they're still like doing their very best to like, you know, give their all to everybody.
You've been very outspoken about American immigration policies, about being an undocumented person. I heard some of your clientele, some of who probably, you know, because they come to this very intimate space, who were maybe undocumented themselves, when they started realizing this was popular and there was attention drawn to it, maybe didn't want to come anymore. How did that make you feel?
Pues me da pendiente cuando la gente es viajando de tan lejos para venir a comer. La gente arriesga.
She's always taken note, and it's very conscious to her, the folks that actually do travel and feel like they're making a risk to come see her and see the
sometimes
restaurant.
Sometimes for hours.
Yeah, so there are people coming from far. She's always been very conscious of that. But also with the recent presidency and with Donald Trump and all the stuff that's been going on, there's been a lot more tension where she notices that people just don't leave their homes. And so that was also hard. But she's always been like, no, we can't. We have to get out. We have to...
Tenemos que vivir y tenemos que salir a comer barbacoa o unas quesadillas, pero la gente tiene que salir. No podemos estar en esclavitud.
We can't be enslaved. We can't, you know, stay hidden. We all have to go out. We have to go out and eat. We have to go out and live. We have to go enjoy barbacoa. We can't hide. we shouldn't hide.
Yeah.
Gracias, Cristina.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for having us. And thank you so much for talking with us. And thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Francis.
Cristina Martinez is the chef of El Compadre in Philadelphia, and our own Erica Romero translated her words into English. Every once in a while, my dear friend Doc Willoughby will call us up to talk about country-style ribs, or a kind of Turkish chili powder, or just some ingredient that's gripped his attention. And I'm always happy to take that call, not just because Doc is one of my favorite people on earth, but because he spent 30 years of his life editing food magazines and writing cookbooks. So if there's an ingredient that's got him hooked, it's going to be a good one. Doctor.
Francis.
Thank you so much for coming in to join us today.
Thank you for having me.
So I am a fan of tubers. I love a potato. I love a sweet potato. But there are many tubers in the world outside of the potato and sweet potato. And you are here to tell us about the boniato, which is a tuber I don't know anything about. What is the boniato?
Well, the boniato is actually what most of the world calls a sweet potato. It is a white-fleshed sweet potato with a kind of pinky, purpley mottled skin, and it's very bulbous, kind of ugly. But
let us be judgment-free about the appearance of our tuber friends.
It is charmingly ugly, let's say that. I find that to be one of its good
unusually
qualities.
Shaped, maybe?
Yeah, it's bulbous. It's got little, you know, things coming out. But it is really amazingly delicious. It is kind of a cross between what we think of as sweet potato, the orange flesh sweet potato, and the white potato in terms of flavor. It's not related to either of them.
Okay.
But really, it tastes most like chestnuts.
Oh, cool.
I know. It's aromatic. It's drier and fluffier than a white potato, not quite as wet as a orange flesh sweet potato. And it is super versatile. You can put it in stews of any kind in place of a sweet potato or a white potato. You can just bake it and eat it with butter or a little honey or maple syrup. And it also grows, it has a certain affinity for aromatic spices like cardamom or cloves or nutmeg. So it's really an amazingly versatile and delicious vegetable that not many people in sort of the circles we move in know about. Although it's also called the Cuban sweet potato or the tropical sweet potato. So in Cuba and Central America, it is widely used.
Oh, right on. And where were you introduced to it?
Oddly, in Puerto Rico.
Okay.
I was in Puerto Rico many years ago, and we were driving over the mountains headed for the West Coast, and we stopped at this little outdoor restaurant, and I'm trying to order in my pathetic Spanish, and the guy who's waiting us on us says, "You can speak English. I lived in Jersey for 20 years." So I did it. There you are. So we asked him what to order, and we had roast pig, and then we had a side dish of boniatos, which I had never heard of, seen, or tasted before. And they were so delicious that I became hooked, and I've been a fan ever since.
Yeah, how'd they make it?
They just boiled it and then served it with a sort of garlic sauce. It's like, yeah, so it's really delicious.
Oh, yeah.
So since then, I mean, I very often boil it and serve it with mojo de ajo, which is a garlic and citrus sauce. Or just you can, I also like to roast it. And I do it with a combination of maple syrup and sour cream.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Like really go like the hardcore, like sweet potato root.
Yeah. Yeah. So, or you can, you know, anytime you make a stew, if you ordinarily would put a regular potato in it, you can put this in instead. They are denser than white potatoes, so they take longer to cook. Like if you roast them, they take at 400 degrees an hour and 15 minutes.
Okay.
And you have to like sort of turn them every 15 minutes because they're so dense that you don't want any unroasted pockets in there.
Okay. So, you have so you're to just making them. Sure it cooks.
Yeah.
Evenly.
But I mean, other than that, it's super simple.
Yeah. I mean, I just love the idea that it's chestnut tasting.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had Japanese sweet potatoes that have like a nuttier flavor than, you know, than our orange sweet potatoes. Is it?
Same family.
Oh, cool.
So if you go to Jackson Heights here in New York in Queens, which has a large Asian population and a very large Latin population and a large everything else population, you will find bins of what they call fresh boniatos, which is what we're talking about. And then right next to it will be a bin of what they call either Japanese or Korean sweet potatoes. So they are slightly different, but you can use them the same way.
And if you don't live near Jackson Heights, where do most people find them? And what do you like? What do you look for? How do you select them?
Well, you can find them in pretty much any Latin market. Or if you have a big supermarket in your city that carries a lot of different, as they call them, ethnic ingredients, they'll usually be there. Like if you're in Boston, you go to the Market Basket, there they have them. So, but any Latin store for sure. And these things are really heavy. So what you're looking for is something that is heavy for its size, which most of them are. And you just have to sort of make sure there are no soft spots in it because they're not cured like orange sweet potatoes. So they don't last that long. So you should use them within a week of buying them.
Oh, okay.
And when you buy them, you have to press them and make sure there are no soft spots. And then look for the smaller or medium-sized ones because the larger ones, they weigh over a pound. And so that's if you roast one of those, it's going to take a long time. So the 8 to 12-ounce ones, which you can also find easily, are the best ones to choose.
All right. Well, thanks so much for the good word on Boniato, Doc.
Thank you for letting me talk about Boniatos.
Boniato away. John Doc Willoughby is a writer and editor based in various places along the East Coast. You can find his recipe for Boniatos with mojo de ajo on our website, splendidtable.org. All right, it's time for your calls. So 1-800-537-5252, or if you'd rather type than call, Facebook or Twitter, or contact at splendidtable.org. And we have Jane on the line. Hi, Jane, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. And yourself?
I'm well, thanks. Where are you calling from?
Real Communities in New Mexico.
Oh, it's a beautiful country out there. What can we talk about today?
I was given a gift of plantains. We got about 12 of them in the little package. Uh-huh. And later, after we'd already eaten a couple because they were so ripe, we were told that you are not supposed to eat them without cooking them. We looked up.
Oh, you like ate them like bananas?
Yes.
How were they?
Sweet.
Yeah.
Very, very sweet.
Like in a delicious way or in like a too sweet way? I've never eaten a raw plantain. And I'm glad you lived to tell the tale, so tell me more.
To me, I'm not a sweet eater. My husband is, and he just loved them.
Yeah.
But I cooked the rest of them. We ate about 3 of them raw.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So
well, that's great.
Why do you have to cook them?
It's a great question. I don't know the answer. Like, you hear me right now, I'm, like, shocked that you eat them raw. So I'm like, tell me more. I want to know more. Did you, like, reach out into the heavens and touch the other world? Like, what happened?
Nothing.
It's just, and I've never heard anything about if they're dangerous or toxic or whatever. It's just always been my experience that they've always been cooked. And so I've always cooked them myself. And the thing with plantains is they're kind of amazing. I mean, they're amazing in a lot of ways, but
they were delicious.
Yeah, but especially because they're so different when they're green and unripe versus when they're ripe. And they're delicious both ways. I mean, there aren't that many, fruits that you can say that about. And the traditional ways I know of cooking them are mostly fried. When they're green and starchy, there are different traditional dishes, preparations where you cook them almost like a potato. You might boil them and then you might mash them. You might do that. You use them like a starch because they're like firm and hard and starchy. And then when they're ripe, they're basically like sweeter than the sweetest banana, as you know, but they still have a really beautiful fragrance. And both ways I know of cooking them are fried. So when they're green, you slice them, you fry them. So they kind of, it's almost like you do a double fry in them, almost like you do like with a French fry, right? Where you first fry them in a little bit of a lower heat to cook them through so they're nice and soft. Then you take them out, let them cool for a minute. You might smash them with a pan just to flatten them out and give them more craggly edges. So then when you fry them in a hotter oil, then it all crisps up. And it's like basically, I'm blanking what they're called, doesn't matter. They come out really fried, tostones, that's right. They come out crunchy and fried, almost like just a great, you'd eat them similar to a great fried potato. And then when they're ripe, then when you fry them, because there's so much sugar in them, they don't get really crisp. They might get a little bit of crispness around the edge, but it's almost like you're bruleeing them, right? You're caramelizing that sugar, I think, more than crisping them up. And they just become these incredible. They're soft, but they're still a little bit chewy, and they're just these beautiful caramelized sugar all around the outside of them, and then inside they have that natural sweetness with a little bit of still natural acidity and like tropical fruit aroma. They're just incredibly delicious. So those are the two ways I know of cooking them, and because both those ways are so good, I guess I've also never tried to eat them raw. So I don't know if you're not supposed to eat them raw. I think it may just be a matter of people just enjoy them cooked.
They were delicious. Raw, they were delicious.
Yeah, and I will try one bite raw at least, and then I'll go fry the rest.
That sounds like a good idea.
Thanks for the call, Jane. It was good to talk with you.
Thanks.
Coming up, more conversation with you. And America's Test Kitchen is bringing us back to Peru with a lesson in ceviche. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. And we're back to keep talking with you. Call us 1-800-537-5252. So we have John from Los Angeles on. Hey, John, how are you?
Hey, Francis Lam, how are you?
I'm doing great.
I love the show. I love the podcast.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, well, my thing is, I grew up with my mom. My mom was an executive master chef, okay? Mm-hmm. She knew how to cook everything, and she taught me the math on just about everything. But There's one thing that I like. It's a delicious goat.
Okay.
But I don't like it too. You know how goat is tough. That's a tough meat.
It's a tough animal, yeah.
It tastes great, but it's got to be a way to tenderize it via boiling, grilling, or baking. What would you do?
Well, with goat, I think most goat dishes that I know of, because it is a tougher meat, you know, usually they run around a lot. They're super active, so they're using their muscles a lot. So, like, you know, these are really muscular animals, right? So they're not really just chilling.
No, they're not, right?
Yeah. So they're gonna have like that intense, tough muscle structure. So, you know, I don't think I see very often like goat chops or, you know, goat steaks where you're trying to like grill it or sear it or do that kind of cooking with it, because the muscle itself is gonna be pretty tough. So I would think mostly about first braising the goat. Or if you want to do a second kind of cooking procedure on it, I would first simmer it, like you said, boil it, but instead of boiling it over like really high heat and watching I would turn the heat down and let it simmer in a liquid. It could just be salted water. You maybe want to add a couple of flavorings to it. Cook it till it's tender. Typically, I would say if you're cutting them into like inch pieces or 1 to 2 inch cubes, that will take you between an hour and a half and 2 hours of a nice gentle simmer. You want a little bubbling on the pot, not crazy bubbling, and not have it be, you know, asleep. A little bubbling. And usually if you're cooking something, even a tough meat in liquid for that amount of time at that kind of temperature, an hour and a half to 2 hours will get you pretty tender. Maybe go lighter if you want to cook it again later in a sauce or something. But I personally cook it first that way and then cook it later in the sauce. If I'm going to cook it that way, I might as well just cook it in the sauce to begin with, so all that flavor doesn't disappear on you. You know what I mean? All that flavor goes into the sauce rather than
pot. Right, right. I mean, I make a nice dill and mustard sauce that could go good with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could do that for sure. Or if you're not braising, you can do like a nice slow roast where you're kind of mimicking the same effect, maybe even cover it in foil, maybe there's a little bit of liquid in the pan, so it's sort of steaming a bit. So it's basically doing the same kind of cooking as a braise or as a simmer like that. Do it in a slower oven, maybe like a 300-degree oven for a few hours. And then you take it out, and then you can maybe give it a sear on the stove or turn up the heat on the oven or put it under the broiler, get some of that crispness, that browning, and then you do your nice dill mustard sauce to go with that. I think that sounds delicious.
That sounds fabulous. I think that's what I'm going to do.
Oh, and one last thing. If you do decide to like cook it in water or liquid beforehand, don't throw it out, because that's a beautiful broth after that's done.
Oh.
So you can use that for soups. You can use that for beans later. Cook some greens in it.
That would be great for like a soup.
Yeah. Or even just like
cook rice with it. You know, like you can just use that. I mean, it'll be strong flavor because goat is a strong flavor.
But, right.
But, you know, if you like that flavor, you can put it in whatever you want.
I love that.
All right, John, it was great to talk with you. Enjoy your goat.
But thank you.
And here's a question from at R. Jess Lavalette. She found us on, he or she found us on Twitter. And it's deep frying question. My new apartment has gas burners. Is it safe to deep fry over flame? Just take normal precautions or abandon the idea and get some sort of deep frying appliance. Well, first of all, I think the biggest thing with frying at home is not the burners. It's how much like ventilation you have. Because I love fried foods and I actually enjoy the act of frying foods. But I think the last time I fried food in my apartment, it was like in the Clinton administration. Like I just won't do it because it makes the house smell for days and days and days and days because I have terrible ventilation. But in terms of your safety, you can totally fry over gas burners, absolutely. The thing I would say for sure to make sure you're doing is use a pot that's really big. And when you're filling it with oil, give yourself at least 3 or 4 inches of clearance in the pot before you get to the level of the oil. You know what I mean? So when you drop food in and it starts to bubble, you won't have bubble over. If it bubbles over, then it's a problem because you have hot oil on your, you know, open flame. So like that will burn your house down. Don't do that. Use a nice big pot. Give yourself at least 3 or 4, maybe even more inches of oil. And oh, when you're frying, when you're adding things in, put things in gently. Don't like throw them in, you know, don't drop them in from too high. If you need to, put them in a spoon and lower them gently, and don't put in too much and you'll be totally fine. And if you have a question, you can always find us on Twitter. We're at Splendid Table. Hi, we have Lisa from Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, Lisa, how are you?
Hey, Francis, I'm doing fine. I'm staying nice and cool in this hot temperature right now.
I am glad for you. What would you like to talk about?
Jicama. Because I've been in food and beverage pretty much my entire life. And when I worked with a catering company in Portland, Oregon, I came across jicama. And we would put that on our coup de thé, if I say that correctly. And I just wanted to know if you have any favorite recipe or recipes that you use it with.
I like jicama a lot. I don't cook with it very often because I think it's, as you said, like, oh, when you worked with it, it was always on coup de thé. And I think the reason for it is it doesn't have a whole ton of flavor and it has a great crunch. To me, the crunch is really reminiscent of like a really nice Asian pear, you know, those like really crisp, crunchy pears, right?
Yeah, I would use it more as it's raw. And I think it doesn't get the credit it deserves.
Yeah.
Because it is such a sweet root to slice up. To me, it tastes really fresh, and I've actually used it in salads.
Yeah,
on
totally.
On the side of squeezing lime over it with a little bit of onion salt and cayenne pepper, and then I dipped it into avocado.
Perfect.
Have you ever tried something like that?
Like that? A little bit more stripped down than that. I had a friend, actually, funny enough, when I worked at a catering company, you know, we were both servers and he was from Mexico and he had this move that he did with basically anything, literally anything put in a bowl, squeeze a bunch of lime on it, salt it, and a bunch of chili pepper on it, chili flakes or cayenne pepper. And that was a snack and that made anything a snack. And I was like, you're right. That does make anything a snack. And we would totally do it with jicama. And jicama was one of the things that was traditional to do that way. Cucumbers, we would do that way, jicama. And then he would like grab the bag of potato chips and do that with the potato chips. And I'm like, okay, sure, I'm in. And hey, the potato chips are great that way. But jicama was delicious that way because you get the heat that sort of like rolls around in your mouth, right? Not like crazy hot, that spike of lime up front. And then that, like I said, that Asian pear-like crunch of the jicama. And the jicama itself like has a little bit of sweetness and just a very mild, gentle, like you said, just a fresh flavor. It does nothing about it says, hey, look at me. But it's refreshing. It's just this beautiful,
cool, chill thing. In fact, it's kind of scary when you look at it in the grocery store.
Yeah, you know? It looks like a rejected coconut or something. Like it's sort of sorry looking.
It does. And now that you mentioned the Asian pear, I'll have to, when someone asks me about it, I can compare it to that because I never thought about comparing it to an Asian pear.
Yeah. And so I actually think that's a nice combination for it. I love the flavor of pear with jicama. Apple with jicama is really nice. And anywhere you would use pear or apple, you can use jicama, I think. Raw, certainly.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Like I said, there are traditional ways of cooking it, but let's keep it to the raw. So I would think maybe a really nice fennel salad. You can take some fennel bulbs, maybe slice them really thin if you have a mandolin, so they're really super thin. Maybe if you want to go super cool about it, you know, drop them in ice water so they curl up a little bit, then you take them out and drain them. And with that,
that sliced fennel,
I would do some sliced jicama or shaved jicama or maybe even chunks of jicama so you have a different shape, so a little bit of a different you know, texture in your mouth. I would do some orange slices and season that with salt and pepper and maybe a little white wine vinegar, a lot of nice olive oil, some parsley leaves, and like that sounds like a great salad to me. Maybe some nuts if you want to add a little richness and body to it. So yeah,
I would just.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to write this down after we get off the phone so I don't forget.
Cool. Yeah. Well,
I never thought of the fennel in there with the jicama. That's a good combination.
Yeah. I mean, pretty much anywhere you would use a crunchy, sweet vegetable. I think jicama would fit right in. Like it plays really
nice. Okay. Perfect.
Yeah. We'll enjoy that.
Well thank you.
Three cheers
and
for jicama.
I appreciate you taking my call.
Cool. Take care. And thank you for the call.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Remember, you can call us with questions or thoughts anytime. 1-800-537-5252. We started this hour talking to the chef Martin Morales about the Peruvian food that's not ceviche. But we didn't just want to be teases because people love ceviche. And our friends at America's Test Kitchen have been working on a recipe. Keith Dresser, Cooks Illustrated's executive food editor, talked with our producer, Sally Swift.
Hey, Keith, great to have you here.
It's great to be with you.
Hey, I want to talk to you today about ceviche because it's a beautiful, beautiful, simple dish that I don't think many people prepare at home. What do you think about that?
I think you're right. It's a very simple dish, and I think that people probably do prepare it at home, the people that have access to really fresh fish. But I don't think a lot of people spend a lot of time thinking about recipes. They just take, you know, a dice of fresh fish, they throw some lime juice in there, they let it sit for a while, and they put some aromatics, garlic or chilies or onions. But we really wanted to spend some time with ceviche and kind of have this perfect recipe that would yield silky fish with a lot of fresh, flavorful ingredients.
Okay, so essentially, I mean, for people who don't know, ceviche is like a marinated fish salad. So what did you guys figure out that we needed to know to do this?
Yeah, that's a pretty accurate description. I mean, you're taking, you know, a dice or slices of fish and you're letting it sit in straight lime juice, sometimes vinegar. And what happens is that the acid is like heat. It cooks the fish. It affects the proteins and it firms it up and makes it more opaque. But a lot of recipes or people don't use recipes, so they're kind of ad-libbing, and it doesn't work out quite right. The lime juice is too acidic, it's too harsh, the fish is kind of unevenly cooked, so we used a Peruvian technique to make our ceviche.
Okay, and what is that?
So we use something called leche de tigre, or tiger's milk, and you see it in a lot of different ways in Peruvian ceviche, but what we're doing is we're taking a little bit of that raw fish and pureeing it with the lime juice and a little bit of olive oil to make it rich and some more aromatics, and what that gives us is a thicker product that's going to coat the fish and cook it evenly, but it's also a little less acidic, so you don't have to worry about getting everybody to the table in the first 5 minutes and make sure that the fish isn't overcooked. You have a longer window so you can make it a little bit further in advance.
So how do the Peruvians do it? Are they pureeing fish in their marinade as well?
Yeah, you see it in Peruvian dishes. Leche de tigre is kind of a broad term that they use for a lot of different things. Like with our recipe that you process some raw fish in with that lime juice marinade. Sometimes leche de tigre is the byproduct of ceviche. So you've tossed it with the lime juice and it's sat for a while. And they actually do shots of this as a appetizer to ceviche. So you have a little shot of marinade and then you go right into your ceviche.
And how do Peruvians serve ceviche?
So you typically see like a crunchy corn product on a lot of Peruvian ceviche. So corn nuts, you know, those things that you eat with beer takes place with
super
ceviche.
Super salty, yeah.
Yeah, super salty, but also like really crunchy. So it contrasts with that silky fish. Popcorn we saw quite a bit, which we serve with our recipe, which adds, you know, again, crunch, saltiness, same thing as the corn nuts. You see plantain chips sometimes, tortilla chips, really anything that has a little bit of salt and a lot of crunch to contrast with that fish.
And can I go back to what we talked about at the very top that you said fresh fish? So can we use fish that's been frozen?
So you're better off to avoid frozen fish. The freezing process breaks down those proteins and it has a tendency to be mushy once you cook it in that lime juice. So really fresh fish, fresh red snapper, sea bass are kind of good fish to use, but really anything that's super fresh. So go to your fish market, go to your fishmonger. You know, they're the people that you want to trust. They know what will be great for ceviche.
And it's such a great dish for summer.
Yeah, it's perfect for summer eating. It's fresh, it's light. The colors are beautiful. The textures are great. You can't really get any better for summer.
In any way I can work corn nuts into my diet, I am all over.
Exactly. You it's not just for beer anymore.
That's right. Hey, thanks, Keith.
You're welcome.
Keith Dresser is the executive food editor of Cooks Illustrated. You can find the recipe for Peruvian fish ceviche with radishes and orange at splendidtable.org. And that's our show for the week. Thank you, as always, for spending time with us. And until next week, eat well, drink well, and tip well. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media, and supported by you. Thank you to everyone who's contributed and made this show possible. We literally couldn't do it without you. And to help support our show, just head to splendidtable.org, where, by the way, you will also find info on all of our guests, a whole pile of recipes and ideas, and you can sign up for our email newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and it's all about simplifying your cooking life midweek. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell, Jennifer J. Lou Lubke is our editor and technical director, Erica Romero is our assistant producer, Chip Walton is our digital associate producer, and Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in, and I'm Francis Lamb. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.